to be different, to create something new, you have to identify, well, to create something new that's going to actually be successful, you need to identify a problem that people are experiencing and, or a deficit in the world, something that could be better, and then, you know, invent something that makes it better, which is, you know, the heart of all innovation and all human progress. But you have to learn how to think like that. You have to learn how to see the world that way. And I think, you know, that's one of the most important things that differentiates people, maybe the most important thing that differentiates the innovators and, you know, the category legends from the rest of us.
Thanks for pressing play. We are sponsored by Oracle NetSuite. Learn how to turbocharge the growth of your business at netsuite.com/legends. Today is a special Q&A episode of Legends and Losers that is an absolute blast that I think you're going to love. I get to hang out with about 75 young people who are between the ages 18 and 25. They are all participating in the Praxis program. And if you remember on episode 170, we had Isaac Morehouse, the founder and CEO of Praxis, on. And he and I have developed a relationship since then. He's an awesome guy. And he recently had a whole group of his students read Niche Down. And then we did a Q&A session. And that's what you're about to experience. We talk about how to design a legendary career, a legendary life, why you should niche down, and what it takes to become undeniable.
Hello, my legendary friends. This is Legends and Losers, the show for people who like to eavesdrop on killer dialogues, brilliant rants, and crazy diversions, straight up with a business twist. Hosted by Christopher Lockhead, former three-time CMO and co-author of Play Bigger, who has one of the most strategic minds in marketing, but could also hide his own Easter eggs. And now, strap yourselves in. It's time for Legends and Losers.
All right, all right, all right. Hey ho, let's go. And don't forget the sage words of Run DMC, who said, it's tricky. Hello, my legendary friends. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is a really fun, fantastic episode of Legends and Losers. We are going to be doing more Q&A style shows. So if you have a question that you would like me to answer or address, or you would like Bix Bixon and Joe Bixon to answer and address, send email to blackhole@legendsandlosers.com, and you'll have a shot at getting your question answered on Legends and Losers. Before we get to today's episode, I also want to say a giant thank you. If you're a longtime listener, you know that Legends and Losers is a labor of love. And never started this with an intention to monetize, and, you know, had no idea where this thing was going to go. Anyway, recently I had a conversation with our co-producer, Jamie J, and of Slapshot Studios, and we were going through some of the numbers. And, you know, it's been a while since I dug into our numbers, and here's what I'll tell you. Holy shit, Batgirl. I had no idea that many people were tuned into this podcast. Like, we're way bigger than I thought we were. Apparently, according to Jamie, we're breathing some pretty rarefied air for any podcast, and in particular, a supposed business podcast. And you may have seen recently we got named a top 30 business podcast by the good folks at The Mission. And so, look, I just want to tell you, I have been blown away. I discovered this, or Jamie shared this, the data with me a few days ago, and I've just been blown away. It's never really been about that for me, but man, oh man, I had no idea how big this podcast has become. And so, I might have behaved better on some of them had I known there were that many of you out there. But most importantly, I just want to say a huge thank you because, well, yes, we spent some money marketing this podcast, For the most part, there's only one way we could have got to anywhere close to the numbers that we're seem to be pulling. And that's because you are telling people about Legends and Losers. You're sharing the podcast and you're rating and reviewing the podcast. So I just want to thank you for doing all of those things. It means the world to me that we've grown at that level to become a top business podcast, primarily on the strength of you telling people. So thank you so much. Now, while I'm thanking people, I want to thank Isaac Morehouse, the founder of Praxis, for introducing me to his students, for having his students read my new book with Heather Clancy, Niche Down, and for, most importantly, the opportunity to hang out with a group of absolutely inspiring young people. And I also want to thank Hannah Frankman. She leads this dialogue that you're about to hear. So, and she's the first voice you're going to hear. So without any further ado, the amazing young people at Praxis and led by my new friend, Hannah Frankman.
I also love how highlighter friendly it is. Like notes in the margins. The margins are beautiful. I love
so
it.
You want to know something about that?
Yes, I do.
So my first book was published by a big ding-dong publisher, HarperCollins, and that's cool, and there was a lot of cool stuff about that. But they make all those decisions. You don't make any of those. They don't even talk to you about it. They just like, there's your book, right? You get to design the cover, which we did, and obviously write the book, but everything else, they go and execute. Well, Niche Down was Heather and I decided to self-publish on Amazon. So there's all these decisions you get to make. Like, is it a matte cover or is it a shiny cover? We went with a matte cover. And to your point, there's apparently we were working with a book consultant and she said most people for the paper choose, I forget what it's called, but it's a fairly white paper with, you know, dark print. It's very modern looking and very contrasted white on dark. And or there's like the old school books that have more of a almost a yellowy tint to it and the paper feels different. Well, that's what we chose because we thought that's how Catcher in the Rye is. This that would be cool. And then on the spacing, I'm dyslexic. And so reading's really hard for me. And when the paragraphs are shorter and shit is spaced out, I can consume it much more easily. We got to configure that ourselves. So that's why it's like that.
It's awesome. I think it's also very friendly for the age that we're in now, where everybody's so used to content on the internet, which is spaced out like that. You know, yeah. We live in a world where people consume tweets more than they consume books. So, you know, having that very easy to digest format makes it so much more accessible, which is also awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you feel that way because we actually thought about all of those things in hopes that maybe you would feel that way.
Well, it was successful because that's exactly how I felt. I actually took a minute and thought about that when I was reading the book. That's how successful you were. I was like, these guys really got something right in terms of the format of this.
Wow.
This is like really, really accessible. It's not, you know, in terms of like, to use economic terminology, it's not like a huge investment of time and energy to like work my way through a chapter.
Right.
Yes, which is not to say that your content isn't worth that, but you know, people are thinking about that all the time because there's content everywhere that you're being bombarded with.
Yeah.
It's easy. It's like short buy-ins.
Yeah, exactly.
Page.
Yeah. Well, man, am I ever glad you feel that way, Hannah? That's great.
Yeah, we got a lot of people on here.
All right. Well, shall we go then?
Let's go. Our record for a call, Chris, just for context, is like right about 50 people, but we just had 20 participants start tonight. So we've had an influx of people and there are a lot.
Well, there'll soon be an outflow of people though. So who knows what could happen?
Well, point being, this could be a record call for us. So.
Well, that would be cool. But regardless, I hope we have a great conversation.
I expect we will. But yeah, we can launch into this whenever you're ready.
All right. Well, I'm stoked to see all of you. Although Hannah and I would have, I'm sure, had a great conversation. It would be way different if you hadn't joined us. So thank you so much. My name is Christopher Lockhead, and I got thrown out of school when I was 18 for being stupid. I found out later at 21 that I was actually dyslexic, and subsequently I found out I have 4 or 5 different what we now call learning differences. I just put them all together and call them dysfunclia. And so at 18, with, you know, my only two options were kind of a manual labor job or start a company. So I became an entrepreneur. I had to bet on my own potential because nobody else was going to bet on it. And the other thing I would say is that for me, entrepreneurship was not just about a way up in the world. You know, there's some people who go to Stanford and they write an algorithm and they raise $200 million on Sand Hill Road and they take a company public and they do that, right? That wasn't me. You know, so for those people, if the startup doesn't work, nobody misses a meal. In my case, if the startup doesn't work, Christopher misses a meal and the rent check and. And so that's how I got started as an entrepreneur at 18. By the time I was 28, I had sold a second company. My first company failed. I had sold my second company to a Silicon Valley-based software company, and I was the head of marketing for a publicly traded software company at about 27, 28 years old. And since then, I've done 3 tours of duty as a Silicon Valley CMO of public companies. I've been an advisor to over 50 venture-backed technology startups. And 2 years ago, I kind of hung up my gloves, so to speak, from all of that after my first book came out. That book's called Play Bigger. And then spent some time having fun trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And then ended up starting Legends and Losers. And Legends and Losers ended up getting us to Niche Down. The big question that came out after Play Bigger was this concept. We introduced this concept of category design. And this concept is really cool. And it explains why Facebook happened. It explains why Uber happened. And it explains why a lot of companies fail. But one of the questions I got a lot was, I'm not a big E entrepreneur. I'm a small E entrepreneur. How does this apply to me? I want to be a legendary pizza shop. And the other one, of course, is how does this apply to my career? Because at the end of Play Bigger, the last chapter sort of talks about how this applies to your career. But it's the last chapter of the book, and, you know, it's just one chapter. And so Niche Down, in a very real way, is a direct response to feedback and questions from people who had read Play Bigger, as well as the audience of my podcast, Legends and Losers. And as you probably remember, there's a couple of big ahas in the book. But the mega aha, if you will, is if you stand back and start to think about every person, every company, every brand, every athlete, I was just chatting with someone before we started about how absolutely freaking legendary Serena Williams is. You know, I don't know if you watched what was going on lately with this bullshit about what she can and can't wear and all that stuff. She just says, all right, whatever, and wins. Whatever, I'm just going to keep winning, mofos. You know, so you think about anybody that you respect and admire, any musician, any scientist, and any entrepreneur, any inventor, any creator, they have some things in common that are not necessarily intuitively obvious. Things like the words people use to describe them are they're original, they're unique, they broke or took new ground, they changed things. The world was before them and after them, right? We just had Aretha Franklin pass, and the world is before Aretha Franklin and after Aretha Franklin, right? She's the, to use a term I'm sure you'll all understand, she's the OG, right? And those are the people, not bad for a 50-year-old dude right there, right? Not too bad. All right. Stay with me. It gets funnier. But those are the people we admire. And those are the companies that we admire, because those are the people who make the difference. And so, as you saw in the book, this notion that it's the people who are different that make the biggest difference. And those people who can carve out, design a niche that they can own, that's what makes them stand out. So the first is that they're different and that they follow they're different. They're not fitting in. That's the point. And the second is that they proactively position themselves. And so they tell the world specifically how to think about them, what problem they solve and why that problem matters. And they become an evangelist for that problem. And it's the niche that makes them successful. And we have this confusion in the world that, well, if I hustle, I'm going to be successful. Well, if you're hustling in a category that's dominated by a category queen, you're never going to get anywhere because they take 2/3 of the economics. But even more importantly, I think, on the personal side, the game of better is so less interesting, if I could put it that way, than the game of different. And maybe this is where I'll land, and then I'm stoked to take any questions that you have. Recently, we dropped an episode of Legends and Losers with my buddy John Bielenberg, and he's a legendary corporate designer. He's won over 250 design awards, and he was the first designer in the business world to have an exhibition at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. He is truly an extraordinary designer. And the conversation we were having was around this topic I want to sort of land on, which is my dream is that one day most people focus on the exponential value of what makes them different as opposed to the incremental value of what makes them better. And what John said was, we live at a time where we need the most amount of exponentialism ever. Incrementalism isn't going to make it, whether you want to talk about it on a social level, an economic level, an innovation and startup level, a societal level. More incrementalism is not what the world needs. And so it's the people who have the courage to be different and niche down and become known for that niche that ultimately end up making the biggest difference. And maybe we'll land there, Hannah. Do you want to explain how you want to get questions through?
Yeah, so I dropped this in the chat, but I will reiterate, because we have such a big crowd tonight, if you have a question, drop it in the or drop the fact that you have a question in the chat. I'll keep a list and I'll keep in the chat, I'll keep tabs on who's next. Sheridan had a question. Sheridan, you want to kick this off?
I'd love to. Perfect. All right. Well, my question tonight was, what would you say to ambitious young people who also struggle with severe dyslexia or other learning disabilities?
I want to answer your question, but I also want to be able to see you.
Can you see me?
I don't see you. Anyway, if I can find you, I will, but if not, I'll answer your question. The challenges or problems or disabilities, although I shudder to use that word, that we have, for many of us are very real. It takes me 20 minutes to get out of the house just because I'm not going to be able to find the keys, and then I'm going to forget that. I can't just leave the house, right? And I can't spell ever. I try to explain to people, you're going to write two books, and on average, every eighth or tenth word, you spell so poorly that Microsoft Word can't figure it out, and you got to go Google that thing because Google's a better spell checker than Microsoft Word, and grab the Google corrected version and dump that back into Word, right? And so I share that with you, Sheridan, just that to say that I understand the struggle, and there's certain parts of it that just never go away, right? And it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Learn to handle your shit. And it turns out most human beings have shit. It just comes in different flavors, right? So, you know, if I could say, woe man up, own your whatever it is you got. And we can talk about the specifics of it if you want. And just own it. And be with people who understand, right? You know, my wife gets who she's married to. And so all of that stuff doesn't bug her. And she helps me, right? She makes my life work. So there's part of your life where you just got to figure out, you know, some of the medical professionals have terms like it for it, like coping mechanisms and techniques. And there are things that you can learn along those lines. If there's areas where you're stuck, there's probably a coping mechanism or some kind of a life hack that somebody else has figured out. So part of it is we got to deal with that. There's a deficit that we got to deal with. That's a real thing. And just woe man up and deal with it, because the give to get is the gift is worth it.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for your question.
Jenya, you're up.
Alrighty. So, I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the Oreo Hydrox thing, but as I was reading your book, as I was reading Niche Down, I had this sort of in the back of my head, because I'd heard about this for a bit. There was this cream-filled sandwich cookie that was debuted in 1908. It was called Hydrox, and Oreos, which were inspired by Hydrox, didn't come around until 1912, 4 years later. But Oreos eventually exceeded Hydrox in popularity, and Hydrox was eventually perceived as an imitator when it was, in fact, the original. How did Oreo recreate the niche to make that happen?
I don't know the example. I'm just learning this now, Jenya. So I'd be guessing. What I would tell you, so I can't deal with the specifics. What I would tell you is a lot of people, when they hear, and I'm going to be very precise with my language, category creation, what they also hear is first mover advantage. We purposely didn't call it category creation. We called the discipline category design. And the reason we did that is it's not necessarily the first mover who wins. It's the first company that gets the world to sort of acknowledge the problem and therefore want the solution in exactly the way they want. It's the company that uses their point of view to drive the world from the way it is to the way they want it to be. And so there are instances where a company is the first mover. They invent a new thing and it gains some level of popularity. You know, an example would be MySpace, pre-Facebook. But it doesn't go mainstream for a bunch of reasons. And Zuckerberg takes the same idea directionally, but actually redesigns the problem and therefore the solution. I could get into the details of that one if you cared. So I don't know what happened in this case. I just learned of it. But if I had to guess, it might be that. Look, every once in a while, the product matters too. So it could be that Hydrox just tasted like shit. I don't know. Because if you remember, we talk about the magic triangle, right? Category, company, and product. And the product really matters.
So Drake's up next, but I actually want to ask you a follow-up question to that, Chris, because I think this is worth differentiating. Because, you know, in the case that Jenya just mentioned, you know, the original category kind of creator, like, you know, the designer of a new type of product didn't actually design the category and is not synonymous with, you know, chocolate cookies with cream in the middle. None of us had even heard about them until Jenya brought them up. And, you know, MySpace was also a company that was vastly outpaced, obviously, by Facebook. how do you differentiate when there is opportunity to, even though a category is maybe already being created to some extent, a new product is being designed, there's still room to come in as the category king and actually define that category and make it something that people recognize. Because I mean, you could also argue, like, you know, you could have a complaint about Facebook and say like, this thing is wrong. You know, maybe there's an opportunity here to create something new. And obviously, like, that's probably not the best idea you could have, but like, where is that line?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And it's a challenge to answer with a specific. So maybe let me try with an example. But actually, before I did that, do that, Jenya, did I answer your question?
Yeah, I actually, I really appreciate hearing your take on this, even if you don't know the specific example. That specific example was the one that was plaguing my mind when I was reading about this, but I was just wondering how you would define that in terms of category creation. So yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Sorry, I wish I knew. All right, so Hannah, let me give you an example that maybe everyone can relate to. There was this company originally called RIM, Research in Motion, and they were the creators of this product called the BlackBerry. And the BlackBerry was the breakthrough mobile, and really most people would say beginning of smartphone, although it was never called a smartphone at that point. And then the iPhone came out a little over 10 years ago now, and of course blew the BlackBerry / RIM out of the market to the point where it's essentially on its knees, and it's in a few little niches, but it's essentially gone away. Now, most people, when they look at that, they go, oh, well, what happened was really clear. There was this big market for mobile communication devices, and company BlackBerry had a great product for a while, but they failed to innovate, and Apple out-innovated them and beat them with a better product. And I would assert to you that maybe 10 out of 10, but certainly 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 people would say that's what happened. Now, on one dimension, I would agree with them. However, and it's a very big however, the better is an interpretation. And they actually didn't win with a better product. The iPhone is not a better BlackBerry. They, from a product and technology point of view, reimagined what a mobile phone was, for sure. And most importantly, Steve Jobs is arguably the greatest category designer of the modern era. And so he explained to the world why this new device was different and why it solved a very different problem than the BlackBerry. The BlackBerry was purpose-built for essentially two use cases, email and phone. The iPhone was a whole other thing, man. And so he had to prosecute that magic triangle. And so I guess to get back to your question, there has to be something different around a problem, and people have to care about that problem. And that's how they go from doing one thing to doing another. If they go from driving to a video store called Blockbuster to using Netflix. And it seems like it's obvious, but it's not. Products can't speak for themselves. There has to be an evangelist, even if you're the product. My favorite example of this, do you know how many years after the wheel was invented, it began to be used for transportation? The answer is 300. The wheel was originally created for pottery. It spun this way. And after 300 years, somebody said, hey, fuck, what if we flip this thing over? What could happen? And so legendary products, legendary technology, and I would assert that the wheel is legendary technology. Its breakthrough use case was not intuitively obvious for 300 years. All right.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. Wow. Wow. Great.
There was no Steve Jobs explaining to people why it was different.
That's insane. Drake, you are up next.
Awesome. So my question was, can you elaborate a little bit on recognizing category potential, how you know when it's a good opportunity to niche down?
Yeah, it's such a great question. So on one hand, there's absolutely, I think, quantitative things that you can do. And at the end of the day, it will always be a leap of faith because there's no evidence for it, right? But the place to go to, I think, is how do people solve the problem today? And, or the closest thing to the problem, depending on what it is you're doing. And if you get a sense for how many people solve the problem and in what ways, you get a sense for what the category potential could be. And then you look at whatever the adjacent categories are, you know, like a lot of people will draw this thing called a Venn diagram where they'll have like three bubbles that come together and those three things are different things, but somehow related. And then they'll draw a circle in the middle and they go, that's us. So in other words, they're saying we're a little bit of this and we're a little bit of that and we're a little bit of this and we'll re-swizzle and ba-bam. And so you can look at whatever those bubbles are and say, okay, well, so there's so many people that do it this way and that way and come up with a number. And so that works, but, and it's a very big but, I don't know whether they did that in the beginning of Airbnb, but it's way bigger than they ever would have thought. And so sometimes you just have to believe, you know what? I think people are going to rent their couch. I think they're going to do it. I can't even tell you why. I just fucking think they're going to do it. Right. And sure, you could sort of try to bound the thing up with like whatever adjacent categories were around, you know, that sort of stuff at the time, youth hostels and, you know, certain types of hotels or I don't know what, and try to come up with a number. But at the end of the day, when the venture capital guys at Sequoia backed the thing, they just had to, you know, spark up a fatty and believe. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Cool. Colin, you are next.
So I completely agree with the value of being different over just, you know, better. But there's a lot of differences that don't matter. So what is, you know, your way of thinking to kind of differentiate between, you know, frivolous differences and the really important things that, you know, separate you?
Yeah, great question. Category design is all about the interpretation of exactly that. So for example, we profile a pizza joint in Heather's hometown, and I forget the name of it, so excuse me for forgetting the name, but there's all kinds of pizza joints. She lives in New Jersey. There's lots of pizza joints, but they are the category queen of thin crust pizza. So if you look at it at a high level and you didn't know any better, you were a Martian, you'd say, okay, so there's this food called pizza. It's blah, blah, blah. You know how we all understand what a pizza is. You explain pizza and you say, oh, and you know, there's variants with toppings, but, and the only real other variant is really thin crust or not. Most people go, you can't build a differentiated business on, you know, the difference of a half inch or something, or a quarter inch, right? That sounds like a dumbass business plan. And there you go. And so I think a less evolved version of me would tend to agree with you, right? And say, well, there's some differences. They're just like, who cares, right? But who am I to decide? You know, another one we profile in the book is nothing bundt cake. Well, I guarantee you, I'll bet you any amount of money you want to bet me, if you had hired a bunch of management consulting geniuses to do a study of the bakery market in the United States to look for a new category potential opportunity and how you could truly differentiate, they would have not come back with nothing Bundt Cakes, the category queen of Bundt Cake franchise bakeries. And there's 250 of them. So, Colin, I don't know. It's up for the world to decide, and how it's a combination of will it resonate? Will the dog hunt, so to speak? And how good's the category designer at evangelism?
I guess that's almost a skill in of itself, is identifying where those valuable differences are.
Yes.
Figuring it out. It's not a binary question.
Well, and by and large, it's not always true, but it is true a lot. The inventor, the entrepreneur, the category designer, the artist, the creator, the scientist, is somebody who has experienced the problem, right? Because it's generally somebody who says, to quote The Big Lebowski, "This aggression will not stand, man." Like, this can't be like this in the world anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that makes sense, honestly.
Yeah. Like, one of the examples in the book, he's one of my absolute heroes, is a guy named Jack O'Neill. And Jack is the inventor of the surfing wetsuit. And if you buy an O'Neill wetsuit, there's a tag on it with a picture of Jack. And Jack looks like a pirate. He's got fluffy hair and a big ass beard, and he's got a fucking eye patch. It's awesome. Anyway, and there's a quote, and the quote says something like, "I'm just a surfer who wanted to surf longer." Because before the wetsuit, you paddle out in the ocean of Northern California, here where I live, and the water's cold, and you had like a wool sweater on and like some pants or some shorts or something. And you know, if you could really take it, you'd be out there for 45 minutes, and you needed some kind of a mofo of a hot tub when you got out. Right? And so Jack just wanted to surf longer. So we, you know, he went to work with rubber and neoprene and shit. And so it tends to be somebody who experiences the problem. We feature Sarah Blakely in Niche Down, the creator of Spanx, another one of my heroes. Right. And, you know, she wanted to look different in a pair of white pants.
So, Chris, I have a follow-up question again to this. Because, you know, basically the root of this is to be different, to create something new, you have to identify, well, to create something new that's going to actually be successful, you need to identify a problem that people are experiencing, and or a deficit in the world, something that could be better, and then, you know, invent something that makes it better, which is, you know, the heart of all innovation and all human progress. But you have to learn how to think like that. You have to learn how to see the world that way. And I think, you know, that's one of the most important things that differentiates people, maybe the most important thing that differentiates the innovators and, you know, the category legends from the rest of us. And yeah, it's a learned skill for the most part. How do you, because you've talked to a lot of people who think this way, how do you start to train yourself to see the world from the perspective of, like, not the things that exist, but the spaces between them and the places, yeah, where there's room to create something entirely new?
I think, you know, we it's a refrain throughout the book, but fall in love with the problem, not the solution. Right. We tell the story of Gojo Industries, and that's an amazing story. Right. And so and what I'd say next to that, and maybe we don't cover this as well as maybe we could have, but be a curious person. You know, in the Sarah Blakely story, she talks about how she's just a curious person. She looks at a table and says, why is this table made this way? And when was the last time anybody thought about how a table should be, and, you know, et cetera, right? And so those of us who are curious, and also the other thing I would say, there's a theme in the book, and maybe, you know, I could tease it out with all of you. be open to serendipity. There are moments in one's life where, and I don't, you know, I don't mean it in an overly religious way, but it sort of feels this way, where God kind of taps you on the shoulder and goes, psst, hey, over there, dummy, right? And I, you know, I could share some of those moments in my life, but you know, one of the stories in the book, John McDonald, the founder of Semi-Handmade, the cabinetry company that's on the front end of IKEA stuff that's so unbelievable, and they're an Inc. 500 company and they're killing it. Well, if you go back and listen to his Legends and Losers episode, here's the story. He's in his late 30s. He moved from Philadelphia to Hollywood to be an actor and a writer, and it didn't work out. And he was, and these are his words, the angriest waiter in LA. Right? And then he says, my life took off when I gave up on my dream. So for some reason, he got this idea to go take a carpentry class. And one thing leads to another. And now he's the founder and CEO of this red hot company that for a long time was doubling in size and still today is growing at a huge rate. And he's created this whole new market called IKEA Hacker that he's the category king in. So you use the IKEA system to do your cabinetry in your kitchen, and then he does custom front ends for it. Because so you have the look of a high end kitchen with the IKEA cost and functionality on the back end, and it's a classic niche down. And the point is, his life took off because he followed a whim, and that whim ended up to him, quote, giving up on his dream. And once he gave up on his dream and followed his whim, he found his niche. Oh, and actually, there's one other part of the story I forgot, probably the most important part. He starts off by restoring stuff and selling them at local markets, right? So he gets good at that. He'll buy a you know, an old piece of something, and then he'll restore it and sell it, right? Well, he's doing that, and some guy says to him, hey, John, have you ever thought of doing custom fronts for IKEA bags? And he says, no, I never thought about that. And then he lets it go, but it sort of percolates in his head for 6 months, and then he decides to do something about it. And so the point is, oh, and Les Paul, the inventor of the electric guitar, exact same story. Right? He's playing, he's a busker. He's playing out on the street with an acoustic guitar, and some guy comes by him and says, you know, we can't really hear your guitar. And he goes, yeah, that's true. So he goes to work on solving the problem so he can make more money as a busker. And he invents the electric guitar. Be open to serendipity. Sometimes God goes, psst, hey, not that.
So you've said this a couple of times now, you've had things you could elaborate on. And I don't want to leave this one sitting on the table. You said that this happened to you a few times too. Can you give us an example?
Yeah. I'll give you a great example. When I first started in business, I didn't know how to be. I was young, right? I didn't have any money. I didn't have any relationships. I didn't have any experience. Nothing, right? So for the first part of my working life, I essentially acted the way I thought an entrepreneur or a business person should act. And there's a lot of fake it till you make it there, which I'm a big fan of. But I mean in an inauthentic way. Like I grew a beard, and you know, I just tried to do anything I could think of to, you know, make myself look like what I wasn't, which was an 18-year-old guy trying to start a company with his buddy. I guess I'm trying to remember exactly how old I would have been. I probably would have been in my early 20s, maybe 22-ish. I went to this conference and I saw this guy give a speech. His name's Larry DeBover. And I couldn't believe it. Larry was deeply knowledgeable, like you could tell, deep. He was outrageous and over the top, and he swore, and he would take a position. He'd say, you know, such and such company's technology is absolute shit. Do not buy it. The current version of their carbodingulator is a piece of crap. Don't do that. Buy this company's carbodingulator. Like he would say stuff like that, or he'd talk about some management strategy, and he'd say, this is bullshit and you should do this. Like, he was very definitive and he was very thoughtful and he was very smart and he was outrageous and he was over the top and he swore like a pirate. And God tapped me on the shoulder and went, psst, hey, look familiar? Stop trying to be like, he was the first guy in business that I saw who was like me. And because he had the permission to be himself and he, you know, if you will, in air quotes, got away with it, I thought, well, maybe I can be myself. And I was told three things consistently. You got to go back to school and get an MBA. You got to learn how to play golf and you got to stop swearing. And you know exactly what I said to all three of them. Right. So I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that answers it beautifully. Thanks, Chris. Noah, you're up next.
Yeah. So you talk quite a bit about trailblazing in new categories, but how would someone know if an idea they have is good enough to meaningfully impact an existing market enough to pursue the idea? I know this kind of goes against the conventions of the book, but I feel as if people don't ask that question, no innovation will be made in categories that have already been founded.
Yeah. So I think it's very important, you know, to quote Bill Clinton, what your definition of is. So for example, I met a guy in Toronto last year. I forget the name of the company, but he's the category king in 100% organic, no GMO, blah, 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 all the good shit today, gum. And good for you gum. I don't know what he calls the category, but like natural food gum or whatever that thing is. So, on one dimension, you could argue, and I think it's a valid argument that he thinks he's winning by having a better product. But he's also the first non-GMO, non-chemical, whatever dick cancer causing gum, right? And so that is a new category. And he doesn't know that he's a category designer, but I explained it to him and he went, oh yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. But before that, he would have said he was attacking an existing market with a we're better than them strategy, right? But in point of fact, he's actually attacking an existing category with a different, trying to drive a set of Frodos from twos. So it's all a matter of what the definition of is, and most importantly, is there a new way of looking at the problem being evangelized? That's the way to really tell, right? Because here's what he didn't do. He didn't say, our gum tastes better than Trident, right? Which is what most people would do. He said, our gum is the first non-GMO, blah, 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 good for you, never tested on peanuts, all that gum. Right. And so if you wanted the non-GMO, never tested on peanuts gum, that's what you bought. And so he's driving a from to. And so I guess that's the way to look at it. I think is it possible? I guess anything's possible. And they're bound to be breaks in the matrix. But for the most part, if you start to look at any business that's meaningfully successful, it tends to be highly differentiated and in its category. And even if it's in a geography of, four blocks in a neighborhood, dominant at what it does. In general, that tends to be the case. Did I answer your question, Noah?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much.
Now, hey, Noah.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So you look like a very steezy dude. You know that?
I will have to check out a dictionary for the definition of steezy, but I'll take it as a compliment.
Oh, it's a huge compliment. You don't know the word steezy. Okay, so this is good. It's a skiing and snowboarding term. When somebody does a trick, like an X Games style trick, and they do it with style and they make it look easy, it's steezy.
Nice.
Yeah. Back so you have terms. Style. That and you look easy. So you're
thank you very much.
Dude.
I'm a form or a functional reform kind of guy, though.
Yeah, no, I get that. So I'm curious, why are you doing this? that is to say Praxis, as opposed to going to college?
Yeah. This kind of, I found Praxis kind of at a formative time in my life where I actually already signed up for college, already gave them the money, all that kind of stuff. And upon finding Praxis, it felt like it fit me much, much better than the college life. I'm somebody who I see myself as a self-starter. I'm a self-taught web developer and photographer, and Praxis seemed to be right in line with the rest of that. So after starting the interview process for Praxis, I just felt more and more confident that I was a fit with this program, and I really clicked with the people.
Wow, that's cool. And so it's a year-long program you're doing, is that right?
Yeah, with the six-month boot camp and a six-month apprenticeship.
Yeah. And do you have a sense for what you hope to do once you launch your ass into the world, so to speak?
I would love to work for a smaller agency. I'm not exactly sure what that all entails right now, but I love working in small teams.
Like some kind of a creative agency or web development agency?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. So just as a side note, one of my best friends in the world, a guy I consider an adopted brother, runs one of the most successful web design agencies in Silicon Valley.
Oh, I'd love to get his number.
Yeah. Well, come talk to me in a year.
Will do.
No shit.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Hannah, who do we have up next?
Emily Anderson.
Yes, my question is about kind of how you got started on your path when you realized as a way out, you could either do manual labor or you could start a company. How did you come to that realization? Was there someone who inspired you, or just you were looking out and saw other companies being started and were like, hey, I can do that? I'm curious.
You know, I give a lot of credit to my dear friend, Jack. So I was working as an orderly in a hospital, and the dream that I gave up on was to be a rock star. So I was in a band, and you know, the thing about being in a band is, you know, the bass player is always leaving. Like, like there's always some bullshit going on in the band, right? Or, you know, the drummer does the guitar player's girlfriend, or, you know, whatever. There's just bullshit in a band. I was working as an orderly. That's how I was making money. And my goal was to be a musician, and the band was doing dumb shit like it always did. And, my friend Jack came to me one day and said, and he had been working in a small software company, and it was the sort of beginning of what the personal computer revolution. So the very, very early days where they were primarily being used as a replacement for typewriters with some sort of additional functionality. Anyway, he said, hey, I think this personal computing thing is going to be really big. And he was working at this small software company, and he realized that most companies didn't know how to use these things, and that we could build a business doing both training and custom programming. So I said, well, that sounds great, Jack. Why are you telling him? Like, I'm a musician. And he said, no, we should go do this together. He said, you're the best sales guy I know, and I'll handle the technical stuff, you sell, and let's do this. And, you know, this is another one of those, Hannah, where God taps you on the shoulder. You say, and this is also, you know, sometimes when you're young, you just don't, you're not really doing anything. It's like, well, not really doing anything else. The band keeps breaking up. What the hell, right? Like, it's a little, so it was a little bit like that. After that, however, I was much more intentional. I made a big set of decisions early, and I went for it. And I worked my ass off pretty much nonstop for 20 years. From 18 to 38, I really didn't take my foot off the throttle. Does that answer your question, Emery?
It does. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Whew. That was fun, wasn't it? And this was a long session. And so what you actually just heard was part one. And soon, very soon, we will release part two of this conversation, this dialogue with this amazing group of Praxis students. Now, our good friends at NetSuite want to help you succeed and grow. One of the main reasons companies fail is not being able to execute in a high growth mode. I've seen a ton of companies in my career who had huge category potential, who were a real candidate to become a category queen, a category king business, and then they failed to execute, they failed to scale at the moment of truth. NetSuite has a deep and wide set of capabilities to help you scale and manage your business in one simple, easy-to-use cloud platform. And NetSuite is surprisingly cost-effective. NetSuite helps level the playing field for startups, for growth companies, for small entrepreneurs. And it's incredibly powerful. Now, here's what I'd like you to do. Go to netsuite.com/legends. And there you will be able to set up a free 60-minute growth review with an expert in your industry to help you identify the opportunities for turbocharging your growth. You'll learn how to acquire new customers, ways to look at increasing profits, and finally, how to get real visibility into your cash flow. So check out netsuite.com/legends. The other thing I want to tell you about is NetSuite's doing this fantastic event called Suite Connect on October 25th, 2018. And if you're going to be around, come visit. I will be there. I'll be signing copies of Niche Down and Play Bigger and doing some other fun stuff. It's a fantastic conference. You'll hear fresh ideas from business leaders as well as NBA champion Golden State Warriors general manager Bob Myers will be there. So to learn more about Suite Connect West in beautiful San Francisco at the Intercontinental Hotel, check out netsuite.com/company. Click on the events tab and you can go from there. And when you go to netsuite.com/legends, you can set up your free growth review. All right. Is there somebody in your life who would love this episode? Why not share it with them right now? Again, thank you so much for your amazing shares of Legends and Losers. We would like to thank the good people at Praxis. Check out discoverpraxis.com. The Miracle Morning, the number one best-selling series by our good friend Hal Elrod. Check out episode 91 and pick up a copy of The Miracle Morning today. Verve Coffee, the official leader in West Coast artisan coffee and the official coffee of Legends and Losers. You can check them out in Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Tokyo, at virtually every major tech company in Silicon Valley, and always at vervecoffee.com. Equity Directory, are you in the startup ecosystem? Do you want to work with startups? Are you a startup looking for awesome people who are willing to work with you primarily for equity? Then check out equitydirectory.com. The amazing nonprofit onelifefullylived.org, helping you dream, plan, and live your best life. Check us out. We do amazing events. If you haven't been to a One Life event, there's nothing quite like it. I've spoken at many of them. Incredible people. There's also a ton of free resources and resources as close to free as possible to help you dream, plan, and live your best life. Check out onelifefullylived.org. The new place on the internet for legendary entrepreneurs who want to grow their businesses and, frankly, grow themselves. Check out growwire.com. And Heather and I have been doing a bunch of blogging for GrowWire. We're having a great time with the GrowWire team. Check it out. And the new Jordan Harbinger Show with our friend and guest on episode 135, the amazing podcast pioneer himself, Jordan Harbinger. And Doctors Without Borders, this is the nonprofit that won the Nobel Peace Prize for trying to make a difference in the world. They go to many of the hardest, toughest places on planet Earth, and they do work that is beyond inspiring. To help them do incredible work in the places that need it the most, go to doctorswithoutborders.org. All right, I need to remind you that this podcast is the sole property of the Legends and Losers Oddcast Network, and we would love it if you shared the shit out of it. Don't forget to teach kids entrepreneurship. Remember, there's no such thing as a participation award. Tom Waits was right. It's okay. Go ahead. Go for a surf. Listen to Run DMC. Don't be lame. Get out of the passing lane. Don't forget to call your mom and dad. Thank you, Dandy Candy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go out to CEO of Rose Acre Farms, Marcus Rust. Sorry, Marky, we just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much for investing part of your life with us. It means the world to me, and I look forward to seeing you again soon on Legends and Losers.